Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Jean-Jacques Rousseau from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So this is an internet resource. Now, why would I want to study, he's actually a Swiss philosopher, why would I want to? Well, I research Paraguay for a number of reasons, partly because I didn't know about it. So this is a little Jesuit enclave deep inside central, in the heart of central South America, or that the center of South America. And when the Jesuits were kicked out, some people came in and they had read Rousseau and built a society based on his thoughts and beliefs. But it really was a mock dictatorship, which became insanely militarized, made it sort of a Third Reich, a 19th century Third Reich inside the center of South America. They armed to the teeth, picked fights, and got completely wiped out. So this is how I learn about these people. I just read through, and you'll hear a few comments. Now, this is the Stanford Encyclopedia. I've got my glasses on. The light's failing here, so I'll read to where I can go. Jean-Jacques, that's a hyphenated name, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, remains an important figure in the history of philosophy, both because of his contributions to political philosophy and moral psychology, and because of his influence on later thinkers. Well, so he's one of the people that you uncover, sort of a bit like Schopenhauer influencing Wagner and the Nazis and stuff like that. It's hard to go in there. He's Schopenhauer's force of the will, which led into fascism and sexism and all these sorts of isms. Schopenhauer, let's see what Rousseau has. Rousseau's own view of philosophy and philosophers was firmly negative, seeing philosophers as a post hoc rationaliser of self-interest. You beaut, post hoc rationalisation. And I think that's essentially my jibe with teachers. They have post hoc rationalisation of their own existence, even in the spite of glaring evidence that they've made mistakes. As apologists for various forms of tyranny and for playing a role in the alienation of modern individual from humanity's natural impulse to compassion. Isn't that beautiful? I sort of feel that, my sense. The concern that dominates Rousseau's works is to find a way of preserving human freedom in a world where human beings are increasingly dependent on one another for the satisfaction of their needs. Well, until, I think we're in a new age, myself, in terms of that we are in a new we're dependent through the medium of digital optical fibers, silicon computers and stuff like that. So we are dependent, but the dependency is parallel, plural, programmable, complex and things like that. The concern has two dimensions, material and psychological, of which the latter of great importance. In the modern world, human beings, that's interesting that Paraguay is now on defined the most happy place on earth. And it's just their own sort of mind. So it's sort of pretty amazing stuff. Okay, this in the modern world, human beings come to derive their very sense of self from the opinion of others, a fact that Rousseau sees as corrosive to the freedom and destructive of individual authenticity. I would agree with that. I think one of the most incredible things is people have a false sense of how other people perceive them, how important they are in other people's lives, and they're positive. So it tends to be positive and tends to overestimate the impact of other people in their lives, is my thing. But I do believe it's corrosive. In his mature work, he principally explores two routes to achieving and protecting freedom. The first, a political one aimed at constructing political institutions that allow for the coexistence of free and equal citizens in the community, where they themselves are sovereign, which is pretty interesting for Paraguay in the terms that they introduced you had to marry another race. That really shocked him, isn't that great? No, Ku Klux Klan. Okay, whatever you say, but the only person you can marry is an interracial marriage. The second is a prospect for the child development and education that fosters autonomy and avoids the development of the most destructive forms of self-interest. Whoa, this is my beef with education. There's in that in self-aggrandizing themselves, they create models of fuckwits. This Australian term, I don't know whether it's an international term, or the fuckwit. However, through Rousseau, though Rousseau believes in coexistence of human beings in relations of equality and freedom is possible, he is consistently and overwhelmingly pessimistic that humanity will escape from a dystopia of alienation, oppression, and unfreedom. In addition to his contributions to philosophy, Rousseau was an active as a composer of music. A composer and a music theorist, as emotion made him an important influence on an anticipator of romantic movement. Wow. To a very large extent, the interests and concerns that marked his philosophical work also form these other activities. And Rousseau contributions are ostensibly non-philosophical fields often serve to illuminate his philosophical commitments and arguments. Well, fuck. It's a bloody hell, because I think this is at the essence that they're turning youth into self-obsessed shits, quite honestly, because the teachers are self-obsessed shits. Okay, life. Jean-Jacques Rousseau was born in the independent Calvinist state of Geneva in 1712. So this is, there's all these independent little states called cantons in Switzerland. So Switzerland's really interesting. The son of Isaac Rousseau, a watchmaker, obviously, and Suzanne Bernard Rousseau's mother, died 9 days after his birth, with the consequence that Rousseau was raised and educated by his father until the age of 10. Isaac Rousseau was one of a small minority of Geneva residents who enjoyed the rank of citizens of Geneva, a status which Jean-Jacques was to inherit, according to Rousseau's own subsequent accounts. Now, this is the entire. You see all these fluctuations happen, and you get this little, these little islands of ancient belief in here. So that's really interesting, how this massive change, political change, but you get these little islands like the abbeys and things like that. You also get the Vandals coming in and things happening. It's interesting that Switzerland, being actually highly defensible, had these things. And also, if you want to invade into Switzerland, you've got more mountains to get through to hit, and it's much easier to go around Switzerland to hit people. Okay. According to Rousseau's own subsequent accounts, the haphazard education that he received from his father included both the inculcation of Republican patriotism and the reading of classical authors such as Plutarch, who dealt with the Roman Republic. On his father's exile from the city to avoid arrest, Jean-Jacques was put in the care of the pastor at a nearby Bossy and Bercy. Why would you want to arrest? I've got a watchmaker. Let's arrest all watchmakers. But I suppose he was into republicanism. They subsequently apprenticed to an engraver. Rousseau left the city at the age of 16 and came under the influence of a Roman Catholic convert noblewoman, François-Louis de La Tour, Baron de Warrens. Mme de Warrens arranged for Rousseau to travel to Turin, where he converted to Roman Catholicism on the April 1728. Rousseau spent some time working as a domestic servant in the noble household of Turin. And during this time, a shameful episode occurred in which he falsely accused a fellow servant of theft of a ribbon. The act marked deeply in his returns to his autobiographical works. I'm just trying to think if I've never stolen anything, but I did say something. I did say something hurtful to someone with unthinking, and he got hurt, and I couldn't say sorry to him. That's in my ribbon in the back there. But the Roman Catholicism is quite interesting because it's a natural continuation of the state. And 1712 is just sufficiently a time for him to get transferred to Paraguay. Rousseau then spent a brief period training to become a Catholic priest before embarking on another brief career as an itinerant musician, music copyist, and teacher. In 1731, he returned to Madame de Warens at Chambéry and later briefly became her lover and then her household manager. Wow, isn't that beautifully charged? Rousseau remained with Madame de Warens throughout the rest of his life. Oh, isn't that sweet? The rest of the 1730s, moving to Lyon, and then in 1740 to take up the position as a tutor. This appointment brought him within the orbit of both Condillac de Lambert and was the first contact with major figures of the French Enlightenment. In 1742, he travelled to Paris, having devised a plan for a new numerically based system of musical notation, which he presented to the Académie des Sciences. The system was rejected by the Academy, but in this period, Rousseau met Denis Diderot. A brief spell as secretary of the French ambassador in Venice followed before Rousseau moved to Paris on a more permanent basis in 1744. Now, 1796 is the French Revolution, so this is where he continued to work mainly on music and began to write contributions to the Encyclopédia of Diderot and Albert. This is interesting. This is pre-internet. People began to write dictionaries, and there was this Swiss thing. They began to worry about gathering all knowledge into one place. So this is interesting. It was interesting that sort of the love life of these various people. Schopenhauer is pretty shocking. I'm shocked by Schopenhauer, but in 1745, Rousseau met Therese Levasseur, the barely literate laundry maid who became his lover and later his wife. Wow. According to Rousseau's account, Therese bore him 5 children, all of whom were deposited at a foundling hospital shortly after birth, and almost certainly a sentenced to death in the 18th century France. Rousseau's abandonment of his children later used against him by Voltaire. Wow. That is a pretty amazing thing. This is it still is in the developed world. Bottle feeding formula is sort of like a death sentence for kids. Sorry, guys, if you're bottle feeding. Wow. But there's something really earthy about someone. In 1749, while walking in Vincennes to visit a briefly imprisoned Diderot, Rousseau came across a newspaper announcement of an essay competition organized by the Academy of Dijon. The Academy sought submissions on the theme of whether the development of the arts and sciences had improved or corrupted public morals. Rousseau later claimed that then and there he experienced an epiphany which included the thought, central to his worldview, that humankind is good by nature but is corrupted by society. Isn't that incredible? So it's what I call fertile question. This is the idea of putting out fertile questions. Now, the thing is that we are so politically charged that no one can put out a fertile question and listen to debate. They're fertile questions to get lumped or thumbs up or thumbs down. Rousseau enters his Discourses on Sciences and the Arts, conventionally known as the First Discours, for the competition and won first prize with his contrarian thesis that social development, including the arts and sciences, is corrosive to both civic virtue and individual moral character. The discourse was published in 1750, and it's mainly important because Rousseau used it to introduce themes that he then developed further in his later work, especially the natural virtue of ordinary person and the moral corruption fostered by the urge to distinction and excellence. Wow. I've just got in my mind teachers. The first discourse made Rousseau famous and provoked a series of responses to which he in turn replied. Isn't that incredible? And this is the entire fertile question, is it's not the answering of it, it's discourse. But we can't have fertile questions here because everyone's whole so politicized. It's sort of like we can't have fertile questions because of Rousseau's. It's sort of like this Russian doll. Music remained Rousseau's primary interest in this period, in the years 1752 to 1753. Saw his most important contributions to the field. The first piece of it was his opera La Devine du Village, The Village Soothsayer, which was immediate success and stayed in the repertoire for a century. Second was his participation in, turning the page here, mate. Great. If I can say, numbered pages and also back-to-back printing. Isn't this the world changing? Le Quarrels de Buffoons, a controversy that followed the performance in Paris of Perugossi's La Serva de Parona by a visiting Italian company, and which pitted the partisan of Italian music against those of French style. Rousseau, who had already developed his taste for Italian music during his stay in Venice, joined the dispute through the letter of French music, and the controversy also informed his unpublished essay on the origins of languages. Rousseau emphasizes on the importance of melody and communication in emotion as central to the function of music, in opposition to the views of Rameau, who stressed the harmony and relationship between music, mathematics and physics. I would go, it's pretty amazing, I think, putting instrumental background in music really opens up and gives people sort of a feeling. It basically, I think music quells the mind, so you're less, that's my view, in terms of if you put a music backing to a piece, it's so hard to do. Like, you have to be an expert. I'm not an expert. Rousseau went so far as to declare French language inherently unmusical, a view apparently contradicted by his own practice in La Divine. Oh, the French is the most beautiful lyrical music language to hear. It's such a beautiful language. Rousseau's conversion to Catholicism had rendered him ineligible for his hereditary status as citizen of Geneva. In 1754, he regained this citizenship by reconverting to Calvinism. In the following year, he published his discourse on the origins of inequality, again in response to the essay competition from the Academy de Dijon. Though he did not win the Academy's prize a second time, the second discourse is far more accomplished work, and in it Rousseau begins to develop his theories of human social development and moral psychology. Well, it turns out that Rousseau is very close to what I believe in terms of, I just think he was against wankers. I don't know if you have the word wanker overseas. The second discourse, the distance between Rousseau and the encyclopedists and mainstream of the French Enlightenment became clear. Oh, I wonder what encyclopedists, this is gathering ideas. This risk was cemented in 1758 publication of La Lettre to D'Ambert on the Theatre, in which he denounced the idea that the native city would benefit from the construction of the theatre. In Rousseau's view, a theatre, far from improving the population, tends to weaken their achievements to the life of the polis. Wow. He was basically contrarian, sort of things like that. And which I think is interesting because contrarian is just open slather to slash people's tires. If you, there you go. So there's the chill's coming in, and there's less mosquitoes here. I'm glad that you understand that important bit, Rousseau. The mosquitoes are stinging, biting as on. Okay, the years following the publication of the Second Discourse in 1755 were the most productive and important in Rousseau's career. Can I say, brain damage be gone? It's really good that, and it's not necessarily brain damage, it's just having enough rest. He withdrew from Paris and, under the patronage of the first Madame d'Epanay, the then Duke and Duchess of Luxembourg, worked on a novel, Julie ou la Nouvelle Héloïse, and then on Emile and the Social Contract. Julie appeared in 1761. It was an immediate success. The novel is centred on the love triangle between Julie, her tutor Saint-Pierre, and her husband Walmart. What? Well, I suppose it can have something. The work is cast as epistolary form, letters, and is an important supplementary source of interpretation of Rousseau's social philosophy, containing, as it does, such elements as the aversion of the rural community and the presence of manipulative genius who achieves the appearance of natural harmony through cunning artifice, and who thus anticipates both the tutor in Emile and the legislator in the Social Contract. But the works appeared... both works appeared in 1762, marking the high point of Rousseau's intellectual achievement. Wow. I do really think the internet really changes a lot of this, because we've suddenly got a lot of time and a lot of intellectual thing. Like, the bottom line is that you want to control that person... You want to control so much, you don't have enough time to control a person, and that person is active to the internet. And perhaps there's only so much chocolate and wealth they can eat. I do mention that in that. I think my interest really came to the point of saying that essentially, if you want to produce something like a space shuttle or a rocket, you have to produce sufficient goods that the people making it want. So if you actually look up at the actual, when you see a rocket go up into the sky, the rocket is so many tons of metal, so many tons of fuel, so many tons of coffee, steak, you've got to feed this machine. If I had a big box and I didn't know there were people in it, I didn't know anything about it, I'd have to put into that box the parts for the rocket, enough fuel, tissues, toilet paper, enough to sustain that population, to make them happy. And it's no good giving them just no name. You've got to give them good chocolate, because if that's what they want to work. So if you have another box and you put poor chocolate into it, you won't get as good a rocket out of it. This is just a box looking at it. And so it's sort of like the balance of society coming out. Okay, unfortunately for Rousseau, the publication of these works led to personal catastrophe. Emile was condemned in Paris, and both Emile and the Social Contract were condemned in Geneva on the grounds of religious heterodoxy. Partly because of this, Rousseau finally renounced his Genevan citizen in May 1763. Rousseau was forced to flee and escape arrest, seeking refuge first in Switzerland and then... See, Geneva is different from Switzerland. In January 1766, at the invitation of David Hume, travelling to England. Wow. And I've got to reread Hume, because Hume is an experimentalist. So I just... And there's Locke and Hume. I wish I could get my head around this. Hume was about... what is induction and stuff like that. Rousseau's stay in England was marked by an increasingly mental instability. He became wrongly convinced that Hume and was the centre of a plot against him. Whoa! Hume is such a boring person. How could... What? He spent 14 months in Staffordshire, where he worked on his autobiographical work, The Confessions, which contains evidence of his paranoia in the treatment of figures like Delrot and a German author, Friedrich Melchior, Baron von Grimm. He returned to France in 1767 and spent much of the rest of his life working on autobiographical texts, completing Confessions, but also composing dialogues. Rousseau, Judge of Rousseau-Jacques, and The Revenge of the Solitary Walker. He also completed the Considerations of Government of Poland in that period. In later life, he further developed his interest in botany, where his work proved influential in England via his letters on the subject to the Duchess of Portland. And in music, he met and corresponded with the operatic composer Christopher Gluck. Rousseau died in 1778. In 1794, the French revolutionary transferred his remains to the Pantheon in Paris. Wouldn't that be great? Wow. Well, gee. I just think that I don't think you can actually separate out something like paranoia from someone's confused view. It's sort of like having a distorting lens in front of your face. You see new patterns other people can't see, and that distorting lens can lead to your brain. Okay, the light's fading here, folks, so I'm going to read as much as I can. I can't look at here. And isn't that beautiful? I hope my voice is good, and I just feel my sufficient rest is the major thing, and focusing on things, and focusing on sufficiently number of things allows my head to click together. Conjectural history and moral psychology. Okay. Rousseau repeatedly claims that a single idea is the centre of his worldview, namely, human beings are good by nature, but are rendered corrupt by society. I think, let's face it, look, the average human, I would say, stupid. Now, majority of people, I think, left alive and standing that I know are good. Stupid people have a capacity not only to be stupid, but to project stupidity. That's my dilemma. Unfortunately, despite this alleged sensuality of his claim, it is difficult to give a clear, plausible interpretation. One obvious problem is present from the start. Since society, the alleged agent of corruption, is composed entirely of natural good human beings, how can evil ever get a foothold? So this is what I think. Evil gets a foothold by dumb wankers. I think so. If you're so stupid that you think you're right, rather than think you're right or think to be right, or just think, I don't know. You think you're right rather than thinking. There's two things. There's thinking and thinking you're right. It is also difficult to see natural goodness, what might be. In various places, Rousseau clearly states that morality is not a natural feature of human life. So wherever sense is that human beings are good by nature, it's not moral sense, as casual reader would ordinarily assume. In order, therefore, to address the puzzling central claim, the best to look at the first details of Rousseau's moral psychology, especially developed in the Discourse on the Origins of Inequality and in Emile. Isn't that beautiful that he's got novels and works? Isn't that a nice, beautiful idea? What a beautiful, beautiful, rich thing. This is because I think people often destroy a good idea by overthinking it, trying to reduce it without tools. So like you've got a big fat chisel and you want to find things, but really you've got to dwell and give enough time to do it. When I think fat chisel, I'm talking about sort of, I imagine, a rock being there, and you can see in it, and you can chisel away, and you get the rough form of an idea. And to a certain extent, that because people want to examine it and publish it, they then basically destroy it by actually rough chiseling, where you need to actually just work on little fine chiseling bits for a while. Okay, Rousseau attributes all creatures an instinctual drive towards self-preservation. It's good. Human beings, therefore, have such a drive. Oh, God. Oh, which he terms as amour de soi, self-love. Well, I think so. However, we're creating this sort of Frankenstein population, which I put my hand up as I am a Frankenstein. They have, you know, I was going, not that I had died and they rebuilt me, but effectively they had. Effectively, if you were an 18th century person, you would, like, I'm being brought back to life with electricity. So after my heart operation, they had two wires sticking out of me, sewed me up, the steam of blood flowing through me, then they fired me up, and the heart began working, and then, so this is a Frankenstein world. Okay, a moi de soi directs us all to attend to our most basic biological needs, for things like food, shelter, warmth. I'd added sex there. Some of Rousseau's humans, like other creatures, are part of a design of a benevolent creator. They are individually well-equipped with the means to survive natural needs. Alongside this basic drive for self-preservation, Rousseau posits another passion for a term he terms pitié, compassion. Pitié directs us to attend and relieve the suffering of others, including animals. Isn't that beautiful? Beautiful. Which I think is a good cycle, where we can do so without danger to our own preservation. In some of his writings, such as the Second Discourse, pitié is the original drive that sits alongside amour de soi. Whereas in the others, such as Emile and the Essay on the Origins of Languages, it is developments of l'amour de soi considered to be the origin of all passions. I have the complexity now that I have got sort of bonus life. You know, I was 3 years ago, I was going to Kaka, and now they've made me a Frankenstein with a bonus life. And you have to convince me. You know, when I'm set with a life-threatening situations, I've sort of already blanked out, maxed out my account. Okay, we're running out of light here. You're not running out of light where you are. Obviously, it's probably a podcast. You're probably listening to it in the dark, but I need light, and I'm not going to switch on the light here because we've got solar cells, and I don't know. In the Discourse of the Origin of Inequality, Rousseau imagines a multi-stage evolution of humanity from the most primitive condition to something like a modern complex society. Sounds like a bit Karl Marxish. Rousseau denies that this is in a reconstruction of history as it actually was. And Friedrich Neuhauser, 2004, has argued that this evolutionary story is merely a philosophical device designed to separate the natural and artificial elements of our psychology. Gee whiz, that is interesting, because one of the things I have to really guard about is just even mucking around with self-analysis psychology. It's real toxic stuff. At each step of his imagined evolution, human beings change their material and psychological relations to one another, correspondingly their conceptions of themselves, or what Rousseau calls the, quote, sentiment of their existence. According to this narrative, humans live basically solitary lives in the original state of the human race, since they do not need one another to provide for their material needs. The human race barely subsists in these conditions. Chance meetings between two proto-humans are the occasions for copulation and reproduction. Childcare is minimal and brief in duration. If humans are naturally good at this stage of human evolution, their goodness is merely negative. And I believe that evolution hasn't happened because evolution's 100 years since. So he's got a thing, but he's got a process happening to him. If humans are naturally good at this stage of evolution, their goodness is merely negative and amounts to absence of evil. In this story, human beings are distinguished from other creatures with which they will share the primeval world only by two characteristics, freedom and perfectibility. What? Freedom in this context is simply the ability not to be governed solely by appetite. Perfectibility is the capacity to learn and thereby find new and better means to satisfy needs. Together, these characteristics give humans the potential to achieve self-consciousness, rationality, morality. Oh, wow. I have got a different mechanism, which I'll talk about you later on. And we're coming to the end of what I can read in this light. Nevertheless, it will turn out that such characteristics are more likely to condemn them to a social world of deception, dissimulation, dependence, oppression, and demolition. I'm going to fold the page so I can bloody well remember, because I know my memory is not going to last as to where I'm up to. My thing is that I think people are too mechanistic in terms of I think our why these classics come across is because they're unfettered by the full set of knowledge. They can actually construct, rough hew something out of knowledge without all our knowledge there. But I would agree that if he was an Aussie, he would say, oh, the human race is rooted. It's stuffed. And, you know, if you... I don't know, there's this way of debate that if you disagree, you're just like this big booth, a big exhibition of arguing. You can move off and argue with someone else, honestly. But the interesting thing is that we have sufficient... I think we now have sufficient time to actually sit and debate and get these things... I think what's confusing here is that we no longer, our nutrition is so good that in a day we can eat sufficient to last a couple of days. We've got water supply, medicine, telecommunicate. There's so much thing. It sort of means that, A, we can contemplate, and B, we really, if you really don't want to, you don't have to rely on people. Rely on stupid people around. It is interesting, barely literate laundry maid, isn't that amazing how that sticks together? And the fact that for all this idea, he actually, in fact, didn't actually look after his own children. Isn't that amazing? Okay, well, thanks a lot for listening. I'll keep on going. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.